106.6.
That was Ray Parker Jr. with Ghostbusters, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with me, Tom Robinson. It's a weekly show where I look through the week's releases in movies and video games, plus the charts, I look at what's new on TV, and news for all three. DVDfever.co.uk is a non-profit website, and has fairly recently had a revamp, so please do take a look. If you've got anything to say about anything you hear on the show today, do get in touch via the Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/DVDFeverShow, and on there you'll see lots of links for all the films and some of the video games that I mentioned on the show, like loads of trailers and stuff like that. And also, I'm going to give a mention to a new show starting tonight from 7 till 9, a guy called Nicholas Costello. He's got his new show, Ill Communication, and it gives you the best in alternative hip-hop, soul, jazz and rare blues. So that's tonight on Manchester's 106.6 from 7 till 9. Okay, what we've got in the first hour is all everything to do with movies. So we start off with a review of Blood Runs Cold on DVD, which came out yesterday. Then we've got the top 10 movie charts, and then look at the new cinema releases, including The Lion King 3D and Johnny English Reborn. Then a look at the new DVD releases, including Chalet Girl and Spartacus Gods of the Arena, and also some film news. So starting with a review of Blood Runs Cold. As the film begins, we see a man lying face down in the snow, seemingly dead at first, but instead he's bleeding profusely from wounds, which we quickly gather were caused by the axe being held by another man nearby. And on spotting his victim sitting upright, he's heading back. Cut to Winona, Hannah Oldenburg, a successful artist who needs a break from a stressful life, and when looking for a retreat, her manager rents her a house, which could do with some renovation, particularly since the only one to greet her on her arrival is a rat scuttling away. Given the type of film we've seen, this will be, prior to the opening credits, you know that when she overhears a regular banging noise coming from behind the closed door of another room, that it'll be nothing more than an open window doing what they do when the wind comes calling. In what appears to be one of those backwater towns with absolutely nothing to do, she heads to the only bar and bumps into her ex-boyfriend Rick, Patrick Sachs, his friend Carl, Andreas Rylander, and Carl's girlfriend Liz, Elin Hugerson. And it's all back to Winona's for a late night tipple. It doesn't take much to figure out that this film is going to end up as one of those who'll be the last person to survive slasher thrillers as strange things start happening, such as Winona's 4x4 being sabotaged, leaving them all stranded against a harsh winter. Knowing that this is a low budget film means you can rather enjoy it in a bit of a kitsch way, so that when someone gets stabbed by whoever's going around being the bad guy, and their blood spurts in high volumes very quickly, it's more amusing than anything else. Same goes for a continuity mishap when one character is just looking scared for one moment, but the next time you see their face, their eyes have clearly been crying for some time and snot's dripping out of their nose. Nice. Especially if you're having your lunch right now. Short but sweet, but only about an hour and a quarter long, Blood Runs Cold isn't brilliant, but it's not totally without merit. There were a few cool shock moments as the good guys and girls are being chased. Presented in the original widescreen cinema ratio, the DVD print is a little soft and conveys that you're watching a low-budget film. Although, given that according to the Internet Movie Database, the budget was only $5,000, that's understandable. The director clearly has a great visual flair, given the composition of the majority of the shots in the film, so I'd be intrigued to see what he could do with a bigger budget and an original storyline. The sound is in Dolby Digital 5.1, and it's okay for atmosphere, but there are times when it feels like it hasn't been mixed properly and the sound isn't exactly reflecting the placement of things on screen. There's only one brief extra, a brief behind-the-scenes piece running about 8.5 minutes, showing work-in-progress footage and on-set filming taking place. It's worth a look once, but isn't something you'll rush to go back to. Such a shame there's no more supplementals on this disc. It's only got a static and silent menu to it as well. I don't need them, but I quite like subtitles on a DVD. And there's none on this one, which is a problem early on when Winona's taking a call on a phone and it's not really easy to hear the caller on the line. Overall, I mean, the film itself, I'll give a 4 out of 10 to. It's not great, I say, but it has its moments. Pictures, 7 out of 10. Sound, 6 out of 10. And extras, a mere 1. So overall, 5 out of 10. So that's Blood Runs Cold, that's out this week on DVD. And yeah, 4 out of 10 for the film, and overall 5 out of 10 for the package. But in a moment, we have a look at the movie charts, top 10 movie charts. First of all, a bit of music in a moment from Niles Barkley and Smiley Faces. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, in this section, I'm going to have a look at the top 10 movie charts. Starting with, as I've got to say, I go through the US movie charts here, because, as I said before, for a while I couldn't find any UK ones, and then when I did find them on the Rotten Tomatoes website, they're a week out of date, so it's a bit pointless. Okay, so we start off with Dolphin Tale, and in this one, this is, I think it went to number 3 last week, and it's gone up to number 1 this week. And we start off with, it's a family drama starring Harry Connick Jr., Ashley Judd, and Morgan Freeman. The film is inspired by a true story of a bottlenose dolphin named Winter, who was rescued off the Florida coast and taken in by the Clearwater Marine Aquarium. A young boy, Sawyer Nelson, Nathan Gamble, befriends Winter, an injured bottlenose dolphin, who loses a tail due to being entrapped in a crab trap in the Indian River in Fort Pierce, Florida. He motivates everyone around him to be able to help save the dolphin by creating a prosthetic appendage to replace the dolphin's missing tail. Harry Connick Jr. plays a vet who rescues the mammal and brings her to the marine hospital he runs. Ashley Judd plays the boy's mother, while Morgan Freeman is a doctor who creates a prosthetic limb for Winter. And before I saw the trailer, I thought, family drama full of life-affirming nonsense where the dolphin will be fine in the end. And when I saw it, the dolphin was turned into cans of tuna. No, I was right the first time. Avoid this, basically, unless you have a 5-year-old child who likes dolphins. Everyone else, just don't watch it. Number 2, we've got Moneyball, which is taking $12.5 million. That was in, it was number 2 last week as well, just with Brad Pitt as the general manager of the Oakland Athletics baseball team. Something that I don't think is going to do very well over here in the UK, because no one plays baseball in the UK, really. It just came across as a film about a rubbish team trying to strive against the odds to be the best. The kind of thing we've seen millions of times before. Number 3, we've got The Lion King 3D, taking $11.1 million. Number 4, we've got 50-50, taking $8.85 million, in which 25-year-old Adam Schwartz, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, lives a nice and simple life. He has a beautiful girlfriend named Rachel, Bryce Dallas Howard, and works at a museum with his best friend Kyle, Seth Rogen, who complicates his life in annoying but humorous ways. However, he is soon diagnosed with a rare type of cancer. Considering his young age and healthy lifestyle, Adam has a hard time believing this is happening to him. And with no other choice, he decides to start chemotherapy and fight for his life. He breaks the news to his parents, friends and Rachel, who all support him. To help get his mind off things, Adam begins seeing Katie, Anna Kendrick, a cute 26-year-old medical student who is helping him cope with the psychological side effects of chemo. As time goes on, his vitality and health slowly fade. Adam comes to terms with his life and illness. While fighting the cancer, he begins to appreciate what he has in life, especially the things he took for granted before the battle. It's difficult to know what to make of this film, as you can't criticise it for dealing with a difficult issue, but at the same time, it doesn't particularly grab me and doesn't seem to make any efforts to stand out. Number 5, we've got Courageous, just taken $8.8 million. And from the writers of Fireproof and Facing the Giants comes a story about 4 law enforcement officers whose lives are deeply tested as they embrace their calling to serve and protect. As crime fighters, they must face danger every day. Yet when tragedy hits close to home, they are left wrestling with their hopes, their faith, and their priorities of men. Like iron sharpening iron, the power of their friendship invites them to face their hidden struggles as fathers. It's out of this honesty that comes a life-altering decision. Well, for me, the trailer lost me halfway through as soon as one character started saying, "I want to know what God expects of me." Now, I'm not religious, but obviously a lot of Americans are, and that's what's made this film get into the charts. But depending on how you spend your Sundays will depend on whether you watch this, quite frankly. Number 6, we've got Dream House. A new entry has taken $8.21 million. Now, some say that all houses have memories. For one man, his home is a place he would kill to forget. A family unknowingly moves into a home where several grisly murders were committed, only to find themselves the killer's next target. Successful publisher Willa Tenton, Daniel Craig, quit a job in New York City to relocate his wife. Sorry, my voice is going. He quit a job in New York City to relocate his wife, Libby, Rachel Weisz, and two girls to a quaint New England town. But as they settle into their new life, they discover that the perfect home was a murder scene of a mother and her children, and the entire city believes it was at the hands of the husband who survived. When Will investigates the tragedy, his only lead comes from Ann Patterson, Naomi Watts, a neighbour who was close to the family that died. As Will and Ann piece together the disturbing puzzle, they discover that the story of the man to leave Will's dream house will be just as horrifying as the one who came next. Now, the trailer is very confusing in that one minute it tries to make out that Will himself is the one that did all the murders, and the next minute that this isn't the case. And therein lies the mystery, I guess. It certainly looks intriguing and is one that, in Daniel Craig's hands, should be worth a watch. I've never been a fan of Rachel Weisz, though. Not for me. Number 7, it's Abduction. Number 8, it's also a new entry for What's Your Number, which has only taken $5.6 million. I'll just say again, all the trailers for these films are on the Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/DVD Fever Show. And What's Your Number? A woman looks back at the past 20 men she's had relationships with in her life and wonders if one of them might be her one true love. Well, the trailer sees Anna Faris as a self-obsessed character, meeting up with the past loves and clearly realising that the guy who lives across the hall is her dream man all along. Yeah, it just sounds dreadful. Avoid it. Number 9, Contagion. And number 10, Killer Elite. Okay, so that's your top 10 movie charts. In a moment, we'll be having a look at the new cinema releases out this Friday. But first of all, a bit of music in a moment from Genesis and Follow You, Follow Me. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, in this next section, we'll be looking at some new cinema releases out this week, starting with one that's been out in America a little while, The Lion King 3D. Now, everyone knows the plot of The Lion King. Except me, who had to read about it because I didn't. I've never seen it. But I said before, well, anyone who's heard, you know, this film before, anyone who's heard this radio show before, will know I don't go in for animated films. And I don't have children, so I'm definitely going to be giving The Lion King a miss. 3D, 2D, any D, just as I've done for the past 17 years. But if it's your bag and you've got kids, take them along to the cinema to see it. Also this week we've got Johnny English Reborn, and I'll say again, all the trailers for this are on the Facebook page for all these films, facebook.com/DVD Fever Show. Rowan Atkinson returns to the accidental secret agent, to the role of the accidental secret agent who doesn't know fear or danger in the comedy spy thriller Johnny English Reborn. In his latest adventure, the most unlikely intelligence officer in Her Majesty's Secret Service must stop a group of international assassins before they eliminate a world leader and cause global chaos. In the years since MI7's top spy vanished off the grid, he's been honing his unique skills in a remote region of Asia. But when his agency's superiors learn of an attempt against the Chinese premier's life, they must hunt down the highly unorthodox agent. Now the world needs him once again, Johnny English is back in action. With the one shot at redemption, he must employ the latest in high-tech gadgets to unravel a web of conspiracy that runs throughout the KGB, CIA, and even MI7. With mere days until the heads of state conference, one man must use every trick in his playbook to protect us all. For Johnny English, disaster may be an option, but failure never is. Now, the trailer makes it look like everything that you'd expect in terms of laughs for all the family without being at all demanding. Ben Miller is back in it as Boff, again replacing Henry Normal, who played the same character in the bank adverts years ago. But it's odd that Miller is completely absent from the trailer. I saw the first one, it was okay, but not exactly mind-blowing. What is odd is that it's taken 8 years to bring out a sequel. Even then, I think it just about made back its money at the time, at the cinema at least. But it wasn't a runaway success, so a choice of a sequel does seem a bit odd. Also out this week, we've got Midnight in Paris. Now, Jill and Inez travel to Paris as a tag-along vacation on a parent's business trip. Jill is a successful Hollywood writer, but is struggling on his first novel. He falls in love with the city and thinks they should move there after they get married. But Inez does not share his romantic notions of the city or the idea that the 1920s was the golden age. When Inez goes off dancing with her friends, Jill takes a walk at midnight and discovers what could be the ultimate source of inspiration for writing. Gil's daily walks at midnight in Paris could take him closer to the heart of the city, but further from the woman he's about to marry. Directed by Woody Allen, starring Owen Wilson as Gil and Rachel Adams as Inez, I can take or leave some Woody Allen films, but when it comes to Owen Wilson, I can generally leave them. That said, while I enjoyed both the Darjeeling Limited and also The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, the only bad thing about them was both of them was the presence of Owen Wilson. I just don't think he's got any acting talent or merit whatsoever, and would happily quite have him replaced in any film that he's in. Hence, this would not be my first choice of film to watch out of this week's releases. Also, this week we've got Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, a gruesome prologue set on the night of October 1910, shows the home's deranged first owner, artist and biologist Emerson Blackwood, luring his maid, Miss Winter, into the dungeon-like basement and removing teeth from the mouth of the terrified young woman. As he carries out the atrocity, he explains to the young maid that they, the goblin-like creatures, have taken his son and will only give him back in exchange for teeth. As the young woman screams, whispering can be heard all around the room from the sealed-up fireplace. Blackwood makes his way over to the fireplace and offers the teeth in exchange for the return of his son, only to be told the offering wasn't acceptable, and he is pulled into the fireplace. The basement is sealed and forgotten over the generations. The movie then opens with a young girl, Sally Hurst, Bailey Madison, moving into Blackwood Manor, the Gothic mansion being restored by her architect father, Alex, Guy Pearce, and his girlfriend, Kim, Katie Holmes, an interior decorator. Her father is renovating the house that they live in hopes of having it on the front page of a known magazine. Due to the fact that her mother recently abandoned her, Sally has become a distant child with emotional vulnerability. Although Kim tries to befriend her, Sally alienates herself from her. One day, Sally hears voices calling her name and follows them, finding a hidden basement with a fireplace that has been bolted shut. She is drawn towards the fireplace as she can hear voices that beg her to open it, promising friendship. One day, she sneaks into the basement to open the fireplace, but her father stops her before she can get the door completely open. The creatures escape, however, and begin to torment Sally at night, telling her to turn the lights out. Now, co-written by Guillermo del Toro and Matthew Robbins, the trailer doesn't give much away, which is probably a good thing for this kind of film, but ensures it gets Del Toro's name in there to give it gravitas. That said, it hasn't been exactly a runaway success at the box office in America, and it's estimated $25 million has only just been recouped to date in the US. And the film is generally meant to recoup around three times the budget to see a profit, taking marketing into account. Either way, it should get an eventual boost from DVD and pay-per-view sales. Finding out this week, we've got Perfect Sense, which is a story about two people who fall in love just as the world starts falling apart. A chef and a scientist fall in love as an epidemic begins to rob people of their sensory perceptions. Starring Ewan McGregor as Michael, Eva Green as Susan, plus Connie Nielsen, Stephen Delane and Ewan Bremner, the trailer really, really drags. It looks like the most boring film about a new romance ever made. I would say avoid this one at all costs, but I noticed that it also stars Dennis Lawson as a restaurant owner, Lawson being Ewan McGregor's real-life uncle, and the problem in the world is that everyone starts losing their five senses one by one. So, you know, pay your money, you take your choice whether this one's worth seeing. But yeah, I think I'll definitely avoid it. Okay, that's your new cinema releases out for this week. And in a moment, we have a look on to the DVDs are out this week. First of all, we'll have a bit more music, and we're going to have Foo Fighters and All My Life. This is 106.6.
106.6.
In this section, we're going to be able to look at some new DVDs out this week, starting with Chalet Girl. Now, pretty tomboy Kim Matthews, Felicity Jones, used to be a champion skateboarder, but now she's stuck in a dead-end job trying to support her dad. Opportunity comes knocking in the form of a catering job in one of the most exclusive chalets in the Alps. At first, Kim's baffled by this bizarre new world of posh people, champagne and skiing, but then she discovers snowboarding and the chance to win some much-needed prize money at the big end-of-season competition. But before she can become a champion again, Kim's going to have to dig deep to overcome her fears. Hard enough without the complicating factor of Johnny, Gossip Girl's Ed Westwick, her handsome, though spoken-for boss. Now, from the trailer, it looked like a cross between a straightforward romantic comedy and a bit of life-affirming nonsense. When I saw a couple of clips of this at the time of the cinema release, it looked quite interesting. But from the whole trailer, it just seems a bit run-of-the-mill. If you've seen it, you know, get in touch via the Facebook page and you know, let us know what you think. As I said, go to facebook.com/DVDFeverShow. Also out this week, we've got Spartacus, Gods of the Arena. The House of Batiatus, is that, I haven't pronounced that properly at all, is on the rise. You can tell I haven't seen this programme. It's on the rise anyway, basking in the glow of its infamous champion, Gannicus. I'm going to tell I'm going to have fun with these names, whose skill with a sword is matched only by his thirst for wine and women. These are the times that a young Batiatus has been waiting for. Poised to overthrow his father and take control, he'll freely betray anyone to ensure his gladiators are in the highest demand, and he'll have his loyal and calculating wife Lucretia by his side for every underhanded scheme, drawing on the brazen talents of a seductive friend Gaia when it counts. Together they will suffer nothing to deceive the masses, seize power, and bleed Capua dry in this audacious prequel to Spartacus Blood and Sand. Also out this week we've got Doctor Who, Colony in Space. When the Time Lords discover that the Master has stolen their secret file on the Doomsday Weapon and decide to send the Doctor to retrieve it for them. The TARDIS takes the Doctor and Joe to a desolate planet, Uxarius. I probably haven't pronounced that right either, in the year 2472. So that'll make it about 500 years after I've been born. They become involved in a dispute between some beleaguered colonists and a crew of an interplanetary mining corporation spaceship over the ownership rights to the planet. The Doctor learns that the indigenous primitives and their high priests worship a large machine tended by a creature called the Guardian. Now, the special features on this include commentaries with the cast and crew, documentaries, a photo gallery, a coming soon trailer, and also PDF material and production information, plus digitally remastered sound and picture quality. Also out this week, it's a bit of an odd release. It's an Avengers special feature disc. Now, it says that Patrick McNee stars as the indomitable spy, John Steed, alongside his glamorous sidekicks, Kathy Gale, Honor Blackman, Emma Peel, Dinah Rigg, and Tara King, Linda Thorson, in the extraordinary mystery-solving adventures and criminal-defeating escapades. This disc includes a selection of rare extra features, including a source from all six series of the original series, including the Golden Schlüssel Rare, a short film starring... Diana Rigg. Also The Mini Killers, a four-part mini-series starring Diana Rigg. Director Lawrence Bourne Interview. Wish You Were Here, Top 10 Avengers Locations Featurette. Death at Bargain Prices, an alternate end tag. An episode reconstruction of Hot Snow, and also Toy Trap. A newly discovered Series 5 archival trailer. And a German cinema trailer. And all content of this features in the original complete Avengers 50th Anniversary Edition, but they've released this as a separate disc for some reason. Okay, so that's some of the DVDs out for this week. We'll have some more in a moment. But first of all, I'll have a little bit of music first. We're going to have Paul Carrack and Just For Tonight. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, it's got one more DVD to look at this week, and it's Sugar Town, which it says is a quirky new BBC One comedy drama series revolving around the small seaside hamlet that was once a stick of rock capital of Britain. But times have changed, and today rock factory owner Jason Burr, Sean Dooley, is fighting to stay afloat as the community's main employer when his brother Max, Tom Ellis, returns with big plans for the town's redevelopment. However, the tight-knit community don't want frappuccinos, boutique hotels and the hip bars, but as the battle lines are drawn, could a new dance school inject some fun into the town and be the way to revive its fortunes? With an all-star cast and offbeat characters that are both amusing and lovable, Sugar Town will sweeten the parts that other dramas fail to reach, it says here. Well, for my money, this was simply dreadful. Also starring Sue Johnston, it was on at BBC One at 10:25 on a Sunday evening. It was the kind of thing that you'd expect to be on about 9 o'clock. But thanks to some unbelievably poor scheduling, there was a repeat of George Gently during prime time. Bumping this... Where's my voice gone? bumping this show to a post news slot. So yeah, this was just pretty dreadful, to be honest. And whoever's got 12:45 for me in the sweepstakes for me completely lose my voice, you've won. So Sugar Town, avoid. Some of the films out this week, we've got Born to Fight, a triple back Blu-ray of District 9, 2012 and Battle Los Angeles, Gantz and Point Blank, which is a film that came out last year. Some TV series, we've got Bad Girls Series 5, we've got Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 8 motion comic, we've got The Event, 5 Days Season 2, Scrubs Season 1 to 9 complete, a double box set of Spartacus Blood and Sand and also Gods of the Arena, and Tenko complete box set. And also some Blu-ray premieres, we've got Beauty and the Beast, The Faculty, Footloose, Johnny English, Saw 1 to 7 box set, Stuart Little 1 and 2. Also, they've got separate titles of The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers, digitally restored at $12.99 each. But if you wanted the double pack of both of those films, the double pack only cost you $11.99. Figure that one out. Ask Amazon. I got the prices off their website. So, that's all your DVDs out for this week. And we're having some film news in a moment. But we'll have a bit of music first. So it's going to be Pet Shop Boys and West End Girls. This is 106.6.
106.6.
And this last segment of the show, we'll have some film news, starting with the news that Kurt Russell is in Django Unchained. Quentin Tarantino may already have already lined up another grizzled veteran, Kurt Russell, to fill the slot vacated by Kevin Costner in Django Unchained. The Weinstein Company, which is distributing the film domestically in the US, confirmed that Russell is in talks to play Ace Woody, the villain. Costner dropped out of the role because of an apparent scheduling conflict. Django, set in the 19th century West, stars Christoph Waltz, Jamie Foxx, Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson. Russell would take over as a henchman for DiCaprio's character, Calvin Candy, who owns a plantation where slaves are forced to battle to the death. Waltz plays a bounty hunter who buys and then frees a slave, played by Fox. Once a friendship blossoms, Waltz's character then helps Django try to rescue his wife. Russell and Tarantino worked together before on 2007's Death Proof, which was terrible, where she played an over-the-hill Hollywood stunt double named Stuntman Mike. Also, the news that Hugh Jackman talks about the Wolverine script. While it's taken a while to come to fruition, it sounds like The Wolverine is finally on track and heading towards production. After Darren Aronofsky abruptly dropped out of the director's chair in March, the project and its 2012 release date were left in a state of limbo. Following an extensive director search, Fox and Hugh Jackman finally settled on James Mangold to take the reins of the superhero flick. Production is now set to begin next spring, straight after Jackman wraps Les Miserables. Hugh Jackman recently revealed that the current iteration of the script is about 85% the same as Aronofsky's version and culminated on Mark Bombach's rewrite of Christopher McQuarrie's initial script, saying that he thinks it's as strong, if not stronger, than the original version. Jackman commented on how much of McQuarrie's script remains intact and what Bombach and Mangold have brought to the material. He said, "We had a script that was under Aronofsky's directorial and it's 85% the same. Darren took it in a Darren Aronofsky way, and it's a version I know fans would have liked to have seen. I would have loved to have seen it also. James Mangold's version of the script brought Mark Bombach on. We always had a strong base there. This is the best script we have had, which is precisely why Darren signed on. I tried to get Darren to do X-Men 3 and Wolverine, and he was always like, it's not really for me. I knew he was looking for a comic book movie, and he read this one, and he goes, hey, this is the best one I've ever read. So there's a lot of meat on the bone there. Now, Mark and Jim have taken it, and I think that it's as strong, if not stronger, than what we would have had with Darren." It's nice to hear that Bombach and Mangold haven't completely thrown out Aronofsky's version of the film, but still disconcerting that the Black Swan director had to drop out. I think we could all long for an Aronofsky superhero picture. Jackman also confirmed that filming begins as soon as he's wrapped on Les Miserables, and even said that the Wolverine is all reared up and ready to go. Tom Hooper's adaptation of the stage play is working towards an award season 2012 release date, so there was no way that the Wolverine could fit in before the musical. Now, a cameo has been revealed on the set of The Dark Knight Rises. At the beginning of Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, before Batman began dealing with finding the Joker, he had another little problem that he had to take care of. You see, Dr. Jonathan Crane, aka Scarecrow, played by Cillian Murphy, managed to escape at the end of Batman Begins and began pushing his fear toxin as an illegal street drug. It was a cool little cameo by Murphy, and a fun way to tie up loose ends. But it would seem that Crane isn't done terrifying Gotham citizens just yet. Comic book movies collected two sources, one from the SH boards, as SHH, and the other from Facebook, saying that Cillian Murphy has been spotted on the set of The Dark Knight Rises, the third film in Nolan's Batman trilogy. According to witnesses, Murphy was spotted at the Union Station in Los Angeles wearing a black robe. Apparently the scene he's in involves some kind of court organised by the criminals of Gotham and Scarecrow, and he will be serving as the judge. How he managed to escape police custody is a mystery, but I wouldn't put it past Bane to free him from Arkham. The Dark Knight Rises, set to be released on July 20th next year, and stars Christian Bale, Tom Hardy and Gary Oldman. Also, the X-Files creator Chris Carter returns to TV with a new mystery drama. Chris Carter took a well-deserved vacation after The X-Files wrapped in 2002. The beloved cult TV series, which lived on Fox for 9 years, helped give sci-fi and conspiracy theories a new life in the 90s and has become an integral part of American pop culture. But Carter hasn't returned to TV since, other than writing the screenplays for the two X-Men films, then working on a video game spin-off. Deadline is reporting that Carter is set to write, direct, and produce a mystery drama with a female lead for MRC. Apparently Carter approached MRC with the idea for the action series earlier this year, and they agreed to take on the project. His long-anticipated return to TV is sure to be met with plenty of interest after The X-Files went on to be one of the Fox's biggest hits. Word is that Carter and MRC will start pitching the project to networks in a few weeks. Project details are slim for the series, but once it gets picked, they'll probably hit the web. In addition to his new untitled TV project, Carter also wrote the screenplay for the upcoming thriller Fence Walker, which he's also directing. The movie stars Katie Cassidy, Natalie Dormer, and Exhibit. It was supposed to hit theatres in 2011, but there's no update on that. And there's also talk of Carter working on a potential third X-Files movie. Okay, so that's everything for this hour, everything to do with films. And coming up in the second hour, we've got a mixture of video games and TV, starting with the review of Driver San Francisco on Xbox 360. But to get us to the top of the hour, we'll have Ian Jory and the Buckheads with Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. This is 106.6. 106.6. That was Rock the Casbah from The Clash. And you're back on 106.6, live from North Manchester. And it's the DVD Fever Show with me, Dom Robinson. Now, in this second hour, we've got video games and TV, starting with a review of Driver San Francisco on the Xbox 360, followed by a top 10 games charts, new video games releases, and some video games news. So, the review first of all, in the latest of the series, Driver San Francisco, the basic premise is that the city's biggest baddie is on the loose, Charles Jericho, and there's only one man who can stop him. That's you, by the way. You reprise your role as John Tanner, driving over 100 different licensed vehicles in the usual free-roaming way with cinematic car chases. After a crash, John Tanner ends up in the body of Ray, the ambulance driver, when in pursuit of Jericho early on in the game. At first I thought, why? Then he soon ends up back in his own car with his buddy Jones, while seeing odd signs like, "Do it, Tanner," and one by the hospital that reads, "Do it again." I thought that meant I had to redo that part of the mission, but no. Yeah, confusion reigned initially. When the game taught me how to shift between cars, I didn't get the reason for doing it at all. Which is basically, however, I was recommended that this is a good thing, and now I've gone into it more, as a friend of mine suggested doing one of the missions where you have to evade the cops, then shifting into another car and getting it to ram the cops to slow them down. Shifting is basically where you sort of somehow jump from one car to another, sort of into the mind of someone else. It was also suggested that I could jackknife a truck or get a bus to slam across an entire full road just to have anyone crash into it for a good laugh. Shifting is a bit weird to get the hang of, but now I'm getting into it. It certainly does add something new and interesting to the game, so I've been swung by his argument. In addition, while the game has a big Quantum Leap feeling at the start, I soon found it was more Life on Mars, as you're actually in hospital bed following the aforementioned car accident early on. So everything you see is all in the mind. Some pluses about the game. Well, at first it felt like Burnout Paradise, a misfire which did away with the fun of Burnout Revenge and had you driving from challenge to challenge, leading to long, dull driving without any excitement. This gives you the option of driving to another one or just shifting to a car nearby, which is a lot easier and quicker. There's a lot of crash bang wallop, which gives you a great amount of fun as you race about and dodge in between the other cars. It's not the most original game, a lot of the time, but still wonderful fun with bold, colourful, smooth graphics looking fantastic in HD, as you'll see from the gaming footage, which I think I'll put it on the Facebook page, but if I've not done it, I will do soon. If you go to, or just go to DVD Fever Games on YouTube and you'll see it there. It's also got engaging, realistic engine sounds. There's also a cracking soundtrack, which includes Aretha Franklin, Dr. John, DJ Shadow, The Black Keys, The Cure, Beastie Boys, Queens of the Stone Age, The Heavy, Uncle, and Elbow. And some downsides to the game. When I first played this release, I found the driving took a bit of getting used to, as you can't just swing your car around a corner and not expect the rest of your car not to swing around with you. You'd soon just about get the hang of this. Annoyingly, although this mostly happens early on in the game before it settles down, instead of just having CGI scenes and then getting on with the action, the CGI cutscenes come back in during the middle of missions, which really jars with your gameplay. Why can't I just play the level start to finish without all that? Also, you can't get out of your car. Whereas in Driver 3 you could get out and indulge in gunfights, here it's nothing but driving. That sometimes makes you feel weird when you simply can't get out of one car and walk into the one next to it. You have to shift. You can save up to buy new cars, but I wonder what the point of this was when you can just shift into new ones anyway. This isn't the only game that's done this in terms of taking money from you for such a purchase, so I can't blame this one. But it does seem a bit of a redundant option. Also, this game comes with a Uplay account, which is free to register and then gives you 10-digit Uplay points to spend in-game. But while at first it seemed to want a 25-digit code to activate the passport, which I thought would presumably come in every retail copy of the game, but wasn't in my copy, I was able to download the passport for free from the marketplace, and away we go. This basically allows you access to the film director mode, which I remember being a default part of Driver 3 anyway. This mode allows you to look at the last 5 minutes of your driving and place the cameras at important points around the roads to make your approach and drive away look cool. However, it's very long drawn out and not the sort of thing in which you'll spend a long time investing in your time. At least in my view, as I'd rather get out there smashing cars into each other instead. There's also a collector's pack available on the Xbox 360 and PS3 with PC to follow, which includes a number of things, including a map of San Francisco, and also an 18x9x9cm replica of a 1970 Dodge Challenger. So, looking on Amazon, it's only a few quid more for that than it is for the proper game itself. So, at the moment, it's worth getting if it's your bag. So, the graphics and sound, I give them 10 out of 10. Playability, 7. Enjoyment, 8. So, it's a good solid 9 there. A few problems with it, but overall, well worth a look. So, that's a review of Driver San Francisco. If you've missed that, then where were you? And you can have a look at the review of that on dvdfever.co.uk. Same with the review of Blood Runs Cold on DVD earlier on. Okay, in a moment we'll be having a look at the top 10 game charts and new releases. But first of all, in a moment, we're going to be having Arcade Fire with Ready to Start. It's 106.6.
106.6.
Now, in this section, we're going to be having a look at the top 10 game charts, first of all, starting off, well, with the top 10 game charts, obviously, like I just said. We've got number one, FIFA 12. And number two, Gears of War 3. I'll be bringing you a review of that next week. Number three, F1 2011. Number four, Zumba Fitness. That's still in there. Number five, Dead Island. Number six, Deus Ex Human Revolution. Number seven, Ico and Shadow of the Colossus Collection. Number eight, Driver San Francisco. You just heard a review of that. Number nine, Lego Pirates of the Caribbean. And number ten, Call of Duty Black Ops. There's also new entries for X-Men Destiny at 18, Child of Eden at 29, and Phineas and Ferb Across the Second Dimension at 33. and a re-entry at 24 for Dance Juniors. Some of the new releases coming out this Friday. We've got Dark Souls, which is a brand new action role-playing game developed by acclaimed studio From Software, a spiritual successor to award-winning Demon's Souls, set in a rich dark fantasy universe. Dark Souls features tense dungeon crawling, fearsome enemy encounters, and groundbreaking online features which combine for a truly unique role-playing game experience. Dark Souls breaks down barriers with a seamless world design that encourages exploration and fosters adaptability. As players encounter terrifying enemies and discover new areas, the game's foundation of challenge and reward permeates the experience to provide an unparalleled sense of achievement. There goes my voice again. Demons, spawned by the wrath of gods, have brought darkness to the world, stricken by the curse of the undead, and many have lost their souls. Players must battle hideous demons and unimaginable monsters to collect souls and find the eternal flame of life, which is losing the power to restore souls and keep the eternal night at bay. Now, I've linked some gameplay footage from the Facebook page, but for me, it just feels rather on the dull side and very samey. Maybe it's more your type of game. Also this week we've got Rage, that's out on Xbox 360 and PS3, by the way. But we've now got Rage on 360, PS3 and PC. It's the latest game from ID Software, the acclaimed designers of such classics such as Wolfenstein, Doom and the Quake series. Eagerly awaited by the gaming community, Rage has already been touted as one of the industry's most innovative first-person shooters, winning numerous awards at E3 2010, including Best Overall Game of Show from IGN and three Best of E3 Game Critics Awards, including Best Console Game. Now, Rage is a groundbreaking first-person shooter set in the non-too-distant future after an asteroid impacts Earth, leaving a ravaged world behind. You emerge into this vast wasteland to discover humanity working to rebuild itself against such forces as bandit gangs, mutants, and the Authority, an oppressive government regime that has a special interest in you in particular. Featuring intense first-person shooter action, breakneck vehicle combat, an expansive world to explore, and jaw-dropping graphics powered by ID's revolutionary ID Tech 5 technology, Rage delivers the experience like no other. Now, I put up some gameplay footage on the Facebook page for this one, and it looks absolutely amazing. But I mentioned on here before that it also wants to install the whole thing onto your Xbox 360 in one go. A whopping 22 gigabytes of data. And I've only got a 20 gigabyte hard drive, and that's mostly full. So if this really is true, then I'm not going to be able to play it. But it does sound good. Also, this week we've got NBA 2K12, which is on just about every format out there at the moment. With over 5 million copies sold worldwide and over 20 Sports Games of the Year awards, last year NBA 2K11 allowed you to become the greatest with MJ in the Jordan Challenge mode. This year, the NBA 2K franchise is back and bigger than ever, providing fans with the opportunity they've always dreamed of to finally end the debate as to who are the best teams and players of all time with the all-new NBA's greatest mode. It also features 15 legendary players such as Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Dr. J. And NBA's greatest hits lets you relive some of the NBA's most celebrated careers and rivalries, painstakingly recreated in historical detail. Okay, so that's your top 10 games charts and new releases out for this week. In a moment we're having some video games news, but first of all, a moment, a little bit of music from Time Bandits with I'm Specialized in You. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, we've got some news, some video games news in this section, starting with the news that Gran Turismo 5 is to be given a title update and some downloadable content next month. Or this month, rather. Creative director Kaz Yamauchi has announced that the Spec 2.0 update will be available in the week starting October 17th. Gran Turismo 5 will then receive new downloadable content during the following week. While specifics on what either update will entail have yet to be disclosed, Yamauchi has previously discussed adding new premium vehicles to the racer. Previous updates have included an online experience system for HUD-free racing, as well as remote play for the B-Spec mode. Gran Turismo 5 was released exclusively on PlayStation 3 last December. Now, is there an Xbox 360 dashboard update for November? An internal email to PayPal employees asked them to test the updates, adding that it would launch on November the 15th. PayPal's added an additional way of paying for Xbox Live Gold subscriptions and Microsoft points earlier this year. The dashboard update will offer a significant overhaul to the console's user interface, adopting the Metro Panel interface seen on Windows Phone and Windows 8 operating systems. Channels can be navigated using a controller, either a controller, Kinect, or voice control. And users will have direct access to new applications such as Bing Search and YouTube. At Gamescom 2011, Microsoft revealed that the new dashboard update will also add Xbox Live Cloud Storage, which will be compatible with all games. The new dashboard will enter open beta next month. Now, the also news that the Mortal Kombat movie reboot gets a green light. Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema have announced that Kevin Chancherone will direct the project, which is based on the popular video games. Chancherone has prior experience as a choreographer and music video director, having helmed the 2009 remake of Fame. He also directed the 2010 YouTube hit Mortal Kombat Rebirth and the Mortal Kombat Legacy web series. The movie reboot is reported to be a new take on subject matter, reuniting Chancherone with Rebirth writer Oren Uziel. Shooting is scheduled to commence next year. Chancherone said, "This is very exciting. I'm so happy that I've been a gigantic fan of this title ever since I was a kid. This is a dream come true for me. I'm really happy that New Line Cinema and Warner Brothers saw the potential after the Mortal Kombat Legacy web series we did and the numbers that the video game has done. I'm extremely grateful because it's been a big, big journey for me." Mortal Kombat was originally adapted for cinema in 1995, a later spawned sequel, Mortal Kombat Annihilation, and tie-in TV series, Mortal Kombat Conquest. Warner Brothers and New Line's reboot is slated for release in 2013. And finally, there's the news that the Portal 2 peer review add-on is out now. Peer review will be a multiplayer add-on featuring a new cooperative test track for the endearing robot partners Peabody and Atlas. Single-player and cooperative challenge modes will also be included, as well as online leaderboards for the new modes. Valve first announced a new downloadable content for Portal 2 in April, before announcing that it would release in September. And the peer review add-on is available as a free download on the PC, Xbox 360 and PS3 from today. Okay, that's all your video games news for this week and everything to do with video games. In a moment we'll have a look at some TV, starting with some TV programs watched recently. In fact, I'm going to be doing a full Doctor Who retrospective on the past series. Just basically what I think about it. So that's coming up in the next section. So it's going to be a fair bit, so I might cut across a couple of sections and then some TV news to follow after that. But first of all, in a moment we're having a bit of music from Booker T and the MGs with Green Onions. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, in this section, last half hour of the show, we'll look at all things to do with TV, starting with the Doctor Who retrospective, and then we'll have a look at some TV news. First of all, the Doctor Who. Now, I've gone through all the episodes sort of while they've been on, but then I thought there's not been a great deal on this past week to sort of talk about that's new and that's grabbed my attention, so I thought I'd have a look at all the past series of Doctor Who. Now, for the first half of the series, at the start of June, we saw the final episode of that first half, and for me overall, Stephen Moffat's tenure has been a disappointment since he took over from the dreadful and self-indulgent Russell T. Davies. Moffat took over at the start of last year, and the first six episodes proved to be incredibly engaging, with Matt Smith proving his worth almost from the minute he stepped into David Tennant's shoes. Well, the first episode was a bit on the bog-standard side, as we saw our new hero had only made a brief appearance at the end of the Christmas episode, but he and Karen Gillan made some intriguing episodes and knocked anything from Russell T. Davies into a cocked hat, especially with the two-parter featuring the return of the Angels. However, it all fell apart soon after that, culminating with a finale that had a Hellraiser-style box named the Pandorica and then being thrown into an exploding TARDIS, which hit the big red reset button and made everything all right again. And don't even get me started on the Christmas Carol special. This time round, my hopes were high, but they were instantly dashed, yet again. Alex Kingston was dragged out as Dr. Riversong for what feels like an umpteenth time. I know we'll get to know the truth about her and what her relationship is with the Doctor. But there are far too many episodes where she just turns up to smirk a lot, flirt with the Doctor, and then goes back to a poxy little prison cell. The Silence were an interesting character, but for most of the opening two-parter, it could have been condensed into one episode, and the actor playing Richard Nixon didn't even bother to do an impression. The Pirate's acting was pointless, and The Doctor's Wife was a Marmite episode where some seemed to think it was the best episode ever made, while some, like me, thought they really did just make it up as they went along. Another two-parter with people made out of The Rebel Flesh were the most interesting episodes of the series so far. But even then it wasn't exactly great and played straight from the book of predictability, with one human being killed off and his doppelganger having to take his place in entertaining his child. Oh, and when it came to a particular moment on Breakfast where Stephen Moffat's words were played back from an interview saying how much he hated the so-called fans who published spoilers online, which he's quite right about this, I posted a link to the video on Twitter, and even though I wasn't following him beforehand, I found out he blocked me. Then, later on, we had Sontarans, Silurians, the Jadoon, Hugh Bonneville from the Pirates episode, and Rory dressed as a Centurion again. And in the last episode of the series, well, before the break, Amy had given birth to a daughter, Melody. It was a load of headless monks. River Song tells us that was the day that the Doctor would find out who she is. Then the baby turned out to be a flesh avatar, as the real one was taken away by the baddies who have yet to be named, and set to be used as a weapon to bring down the Doctor. Huh? They're the ones who projected a fake Amy signal into the TARDIS, somehow managing to beam it in from the outside. We saw the Doctor's cot from when he was a child, and initially River Song made things out as if she was his mum. Yes, his mum. Despite all the kissing, etc. And then the Doctor went off in his TARDIS, as you do. Then we found out that River was actually Amy's daughter, Melody, all grown up, and then it ended. After all, I thought that last episode was immensely disappointing. It was just a perfect case of, let's throw all the old rubbish at the wall and see how much sticks. Moffat was much better than this. In fact, at one point, I was wondering if... did Russell T. Davies write that one? It was like all of his terrible episodes lumped into one. I thought we'd got away with all that from Moffat. In fact, I couldn't get away from being like a mishmash of Russell T. Davies' cast-offs, with a few from Moffat's era all thrown in with no structure. Then we had Doctor Who, when the series returned in... yes, I think it was like the end of August it came back. The first episode was Let's Kill Hitler. When it came to Let's Kill Hitler, the first overhype was from the title. There was hardly any Hitler. And before you could try and work it out just how bad the likeness was, the actor playing him was bundled into a cupboard by Rory and never seen again. On the one hand, it was good that the episode introduced River Song, as we knew she was Amy's daughter, but she also turned out to be the young girl who we saw earlier in the series about to regenerate. We discovered that this girl had since regenerated into a friend of Amy and Rory's called Mel's, and now after ending up with them in Berlin 1938, she took a bullet and became Riversong. Later, the Doctor found himself dead, again, but River saved the day by giving up any chance of further regenerations by saving him. And while Rory locking up Hitler was amusing, I found a complete lack of tension at the potential of anyone's death. It happens far too often, so you know they'll survive quite easily. And then after that we had Night Terrors, which was the second episode. And that was even more of a disappointment. The League of Gentlemen's Mark Gatiss wrote a script that spent over half of its time doing the build-up. Then once all the main cast members were in a situation where they were about to end up as wooden dolls for the rest of their life, along came a resolution that took around 1 minute to resolve. This is just the kind of pathetic John we get used to from Russell T. Davies on a regular basis. At that point, I was hoping, well, there's still four more episodes to go. So surely it was, some good stuff to come, surely. But we shall see. First of all, have just a bit of music before we have that next episode. We've got the Human League and the Sound of the Crowd. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, back with the second part of our look back at Doctor Who, the whole of the series. The next episode we're looking at is The Girl Who Waited, in which Amy is trapped in a quarantine facility for victims of an alien plague. But could Rory save her before she's killed by kindness? Well, the kindness was thanks to some robots who wanted to give Amy some antibiotics. But as she wasn't from their world, this would effectively be killing her with kindness. Amy basically finds herself in a faster time stream from the Doctor and Rory, and when they eventually catch up with her, she's 36 years older. But how to work out what's gone wrong and get everything back to square one? This resulted in an older Amy having to basically allow herself to stop existing, although she wanted to see if she could live as well by having Rory take her back into the TARDIS, as well as the younger Amy. So somehow they could both live, and the TARDIS would stop any paradox problems by the Doctor getting enough power for this by jettisoning the karaoke bar. Did you follow any of that? I certainly know I didn't. In the end, like with Highlander, sort of, there can be only one. Overall, it didn't half plod on, and the older Amy let herself get bumped off by the handbots. Then we had the God Complex, and the TARDIS landed in a hotel where every visitor's room contained their deepest, darkest fears. But what lies in wait in the Doctor's room? Well, before the credits, we saw policewoman Lucy Haywood, who said that you never know what's going to be in your room, and when you find out, you realise it could never be anything else. They meet four people in the hotel who have yet to discover their fears, but when it comes to Amy's room, they see the weeping angels, but they can't kill anyone, because, as the Doctor finds out, they're not real. There was a Minotaur running around the hotel who would attack whoever praised it enough, and to constantly say praise him was like an addiction, and it gave them a feeling of being blessed, and it was okay to face the beast, as if they didn't realise it was going to kill them. And we also had David Walliams as a weird-looking alien who was also another hotel resident. Annoyingly, at one point, the Doctor found his room, looked inside, without showing us, and he said, "Oh, of course, it's you." Pfft, who? You know. In the end, in Amy's room, it was actually herself as a child. The Doctor told her to forget her faith in him, and that he robbed her of her childhood, and shouldn't have waited for him all those years. He told her it's time to stop waiting, and with that, and a few lightning shocks, the Minotaur was dead. And so it plodded on until the end, although the last 5 minutes were as good as the Doctor dropped Amy and Rory off at their house, with Rory's perfect car, and then disappeared into the TARDIS. But would that be the end for Amy and Rory? At the time I doubted it, as it's not even the series finale. After that, we had closing time, where it said the Doctor's final days were upon him, when he drops in on an old friend, the Cybermen are waiting. Well, the old friend was James Corden, as Craig, who lives with his girlfriend Sophie and their new baby, and last year Corden's was one of the worst episodes shown. Now, various people in the town had gone missing in the last few days, along with all the customers in Craig's toy shop. Add to that, we had the return of the Cybermen, and when both Craig and the Doctor use a lift in the store that's meant to be out of order, they found it's actually linked as a teleport relay to the Cybermen's spaceship. Now, since the Doctor told Amy to forget him in the previous week so that he no longer ruined her childhood, as he and Craig went through the store, he saw Amy and Rory on the other side, with Amy signing a photograph, her autograph for a girl. As he looked up, he saw a billboard that showed Amy is the face of a perfume with the tagline, "For the girl who's tired of waiting," obviously referring to the earlier episode. All the while, the Doctor goes on about how his time is running out and how that happens tomorrow. It's just the day, I thought, where he meets the impossible astronaut who kills him, but the other him, back to the Cybermen, and it turned out there wasn't a teleporter. They were deep underground, or it wasn't just a teleporter, they were deep underground all along. The council just built a shopping mall on top of them. Most disappointingly, at one point, Craig was sealed inside a Cyberman suit and was never going to be seen again. But he could hear his baby crying. He was elsewhere in the store being looked after by Linda Barron. The crying enabled him to break free by bringing back his emotions, and as the Doctor called it, he killed them with love. Oh dear. Finally, we had the wedding of Riversong that was on last Saturday. And by the shores of Lake Silencio in Utah, all of time and space hang in the balance, for this is the day the Doctor dies. Well, as this episode began, there was a crossover of many different stories, many past stories. Winston Churchill was a Holy Roman Emperor, and one of his minions was a Silurian. Meanwhile, Charles Dickens was being interviewed by Bill and Sean on Breakfast. Basically, time's gone completely up the creek, with all of history happening at once. What caused this? Churchill asks a prisoner who looks up, reveals himself to be the Doctor, who replies, "A woman." Then, while back in the TARDIS, he got a phone call telling him that Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart had died a few months ago. something that actually happened in there to the actor Nicholas Courtney. Fast forward to Lake Silencio and to the moment where the Doctor dies and the astronaut reveals themselves to be River Song, who doesn't want to kill the Doctor, but the suit's overpowering her, and he tells her it has to happen. But when she fires, nothing comes out. Somehow she's drained the weapon systems. Throwing some more nonsense where the Doctor, as Churchill's prisoner, find themselves looking at scores of the silence on the ceiling. Then Amy Pond, somehow as a baddie, rushes in with the army. Amy knocks out the Doctor, and when he wakes up, she reveals she's just a normal self, and that this was a front, and she's back with his suit. Cue lots of yawn-inducing, incomprehensible nonsense that made no sense at all about time stopping dead at 5:02 p.m. on April the 22nd this year, the moment the Doctor was meant to die. Everyone ended up in a pyramid known as Area 52, where the silence are being held, but they've escaped and tried to kill all the good guys and girls. And naturally, everyone escapes, except Frances Barber, the woman who kept appearing to Amy earlier in the series through a slot in the door. Even then, there wasn't a slot there. Then River married the Doctor, they kissed, and this restored time so that the Doctor died. River went to prison for his murder, and Amy was back at home, with River. Yes, this just made absolutely no sense at all. So to add to that, bring back the miniature people in a spaceship that can transform into anything at all. Make him appear as a Doctor, so the Doctor ends up inside the Doctor suit, so he survives being killed and burned into a Viking ritual, and then survives to fight another series. Oh, and a Christmas special. What a load of complete and utter tosh that was. The end. So there's your Doctor Who there. Something that's coming up this week. On Thursday night, we've got Hidden, which is the first episode. It's on Thursday at 9 o'clock on BBC One. It's the first episode of a four-part conspiracy thriller in which small-time solicitor Harry Venn is forced to revisit his murky past when he is approached by a mysterious and glamorous lawyer, Gina Hawkes, looking for a missing alibi witness for a client. Harry quickly finds himself plunged into a deep and dangerous conspiracy. It stars Philip Glenister, Thecla Rooten, Anna Chancellor, Matthew Marsh, Betty Carvel and Richard Dormer. And the trailer makes it look all cool and movie-like with Kasabian's Days of Forgotten playing in the background. But it doesn't give away anything about the storyline at all. Now, at this point, I'd normally play another song, but if I do that, then I've only got about... How much have I got left? About... Well, I only have a couple of minutes if I did play another song. So I think at this point, I'll just go straight into the TV news. And the first bit of TV news we've got for you is that Deal or No Deal, for the first time ever, is going live. And it all kicks off at 4 o'clock on Monday next week. on Channel 4, obviously. Over 2 weeks, 12 nail-biting games will play out live from the Dream Factory. At the helm of this live extravaganza will, of course, be Noel Edmonds. As always, the dastardly banker. Careful how you say that. The banker will be keeping an eye on proceedings, endeavouring to thwart the attempts of the contestants to win big. However, in a new twist of the show, Noel will be making his way around the country, knocking on doors to surprise the contestants. So you never know, if you hear the doorbell ring, it could be you. Since the show's launch in 2005, there have been some classic games, some unbelievably tense moments, lots of dressing up, and three quarter millionaires, but there's since been four. Will the Deal or No Deal live see the crowning of a new quarter millionaire? Or will a penny-pinching banker be adding even more members to his infamous 1P club? We've also got the news that Gold commissions sitcom documentary series. The digital comedy channel UK TV Gold has commissioned a four-part documentary series looking at British sitcoms. Only in a sitcom will... aim to demonstrate how British sitcom reflects everyday life. Family romance, friendship, and Christmas have been identified as four... Sorry, family, romance, friendship, and Christmas have been identified as four key themes to examine, with an hour-long episode dedicated to each. Outnumbered actor Hugh Dennis will look at the pivotal role of the family in sitcom. Gavin and Stacey star Joanna Page will explore the topic of romance. And Men Behaving Badly's Neil Morrissey looks at the world of friendships. And the Royal Family actor, Ricky Tomlinson, will give his unique take on Christmas. Reflecting on how successful Sitcoms create comedy from the humdrum of everyday existence. Each episode will open with the host before throwing to clips illustrating each point. There will also be interviews with those involved in the comedies being talked about. For example, Wendy Craig and Bruce Montague will talk about butterflies, and Sue Johnson will discuss the royal family. Julie Swanson, who developed the series for Gold, says, "The calibre of talent we've secured for this series from Hugh, Neil, Joanna and Ricky, to outstanding contributors including Miranda Hart, James Dreyfuss and Alison Steadman, Sally Phillips and more, is a testament to the idiosyncratic appeal of the British sitcom." And the episodes will be shown at the end of the year over the festive period. And we've also got the news that Stephen Fry is to join Bleak Expectations, or a Bleak Expectations inspired TV series. After months of speculation, the TV series based on Radio 4's hit sitcom Bleak Expectations has been confirmed. The bleak old shop of stuff, which is inspired by the Dickensian adventure, rather than being an adaptation of it, will start filming 4 programmes from this week. Excuse me. The series, with the same creator and writer Mark Evans, will consist of 3 half-hour episodes telling the story of a particular family in Victorian London. A show will launch on Christmas Eve with a separate 60-minute special and is a BBC in-house production for BBC Two. Evans explained, "It is essentially in the same world, but with none of the characters from the radio series. And like the much-loved Bleak Expectations, which is due to record its 5th and final series early in 2012, the bleak old shop of stuff will not be recorded in front of an audience and will contain an entirely new set of characters." Robert Webb is due to star as the show's central hero figure, Chedrington, and Catherine Parkinson will play his wife, Conceptiva. My voice is going again. Excuse me. A special Christmas episode would also feature Stephen Fry as a villainous lawyer, Malifax Skulking Worm. Sarah Hadland, a regular of Bleak Expectations and star of Miranda, will play the role of mean governess, Miss Tight Clench, and the full lineup has yet to be confirmed, but with other names set to appear include Johnny Vegas, Celia Imrie, Tim McHenry, Webb's comedy partner David Mitchell, and also Kevin Eldon. BBC head of comedy Mark Freeland said, "Mark Evans' already well-loved Victorian comic world is a wonderful way to celebrate the bicentenary of Dickens' birth. He probably wouldn't have agreed, but I am very excited." Robert Webb also added, "I'm really looking forward to working with my all-time hero, David Mitchell. Apparently Stephen Fry is in it too, which is nice." The ridiculous Dickensian adventure will be directed by Ben Gosling Fuller and overseen by the Bleak Expectations producer, Gareth Edwards. Okay, so that's everything for this week. So that's all your films, games and TV. And clearly that's rather long Doctor Who retrospective, which took me longer to go through than I expected. And you missed out on a song. I was going to play Tears for Fears, Tales, Pale Shelter, but I had to take that out. You could hear me talking instead. In a moment, we've got... don't forget all the links to everything, all the films and a lot of the game footage is on the Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/DVDFeverShow. Also, coming up at 2 o'clock, we've got the Aaron Metta Show. And again, we've got, as I mentioned, got a new show from Nicholas Costello called Ill Communication, starting from 7 till 9 tonight, which brings you the very best in alternative hip-hop, soul, jazz and rare blues. But until next week, that's the end of the DVD Fever show. I say, have a look on anything you like on the Facebook page or go to dvdfever.co.uk. And we're back this time next week. And okay, so to play us out, to take us to the top of the hour, we've got Susie and the Banshees and Happy House. This is 106.6.
106.6.